When you're a rich kid, you don't have any troubles or any worries. When you're a rich kid, the world is your oyster, or so it seems. You are sometimes alone, alone with your pennies and alone with your thoughts. But you're ready for adventure, or so it seems. Suddenly adventure finds you. It snatches you up. You are the one. You're no longer a rich kid. Now you're a ransom. Suddenly adventure hands you. Suddenly adventure hands you some fun. Jimmy the kid. Jimmy the kid. Blink and you'll forget it. Jimmy the kid. Open your eyes. Close them again. It's still on. Jimmy the kid. Blink and you will forget it. Jimmy the kid. You're a rich kid and you want some adventure. Oh, you'll get adventure. You'll get lengthy, drawn out adventure. Wait for it. No, we're still waiting. Adventure. Open your eyes and close them again. You just lived an adventure, rich kid. Jimmy the kid. Jimmy the kid. Music.
Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. Every movie. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
I am very angry.
And Erica.
I don't know. I put my troubles in the hands of an old lady, and a small breeze just blew them out of her hands, and now they're gone. So I wrote them all down on a piece of paper. She was responsible for them. They're all gone now, thanks to an unfortunate breeze. Yeah. So
it'll happen when you're up there on a telephone pole, high above the ground. And welcome, everyone, to Ha-Ha-August!
Ha-Ha-August!
Two! Double take! Well, we're going to talk about the comedy movies released by New World Pictures. And boy, do we have one for you. I will say, this is a significant movie in New World history.
Oh.
And we will get to that later on in the movie, later on in the podcast. I will explain what I mean, but it is significant. What movie are we talking about? Well, you clicked on it and read the title. It's 1982's Jimmy the Kid.
Gary Coleman is Jimmy the Kid.
Maurice. Get thicker glasses.
Right. Jimmy the Kid. And these kidnappers are planning the child heist of the year. They're diabolically clever. Masterminds of disguise.
You know, when this is all over, we ought to get a group picture.
Incredibly well financed.
Hi, can I take your order, please?
Above and beyond the law.
You're in a no parking zone, sir.
Brilliant organizational planners.
Well, first we're going to lower the back door of that truck.
Who planned this thing? The Three Stooges?
Downright me.
Hey! You guys just broke the law, you know that?
And there's only one man that can stop them. Calling me in was the smartest thing you could do. Jimmy the Kid. Action.
I love a good chase.
Adventure.
Hey, look who's driving!
And drama.
You think I look better as a blonde?
Oh, I love you as a
brunette. This is a terrific movie.
Would you believe hysterical? Jimmy the Kid.
That's right, 1982's Jimmy the Kid, brought to you by Ronnie's Loose Floorboards. Are you planning a new floor but want it loose, removable, without a subfloor? Ronnie can help. Our floorboards are specifically designed to not move under your feet, yet are easily moved by hand if you're looking to hide valuables, set rodent traps, or escape because you're a 12-year-old who's been kidnapped. Call Ronnie for a quote today and get our special reverse flooring for when you're under the house and desperately need back in.
Very important.
Ronnie does it both ways. He floors it both ways. Yeah, should have been more specific. He floors it both floors ways.
Yes, he does. This movie is directed by Gary Nelson, who had directed many episodes of, guess what, Get Smart, as well as the original 1976 film Freaky Friday and 1979's The Black Hole. This is based on the book by Donald E. Westlake, whose books involving the hard-boiled robber character of Parker have been turned into several movies, including 1967's Point Blank with Lee Marvin, 1999's Payback with Chill Bro Mel Gibson, to 2013's Parker with Jason Statham. Westlake had also written several...
Sorry, did you say Jason Statham?
Hey, it's me, Jason Statham. I'm playing Parker.
I was hoping that you were going to say Parker Lewis can't lose, but I guess we wouldn't have a good...
I'm definitely going to win. I'm Parker Lewis. Can't lose, so I will win, because that's what I do.
Can you just say synchronized watches, Jason Statham?
Let's synchronize our watches. Parker style.
Westlake had also written several more comedic novels around the characters of John Dortmunder and Andy Kelp, which were also turned into movies such turned into movies such as 1972's The Hot Rock with Robert Redford and George Segal, 1974's Bank Shot with George C. Scott, 2001's What's the Worst That Could Happen starring Martin Lawrence, and, well, this... The screenplay is written by Sam Bobrick, who was a playwright, with his first play being 1970's Norman Is That You, co-written with Ron Clark, who wrote and directed The Funny Farm. Not that funny farm. The Funny Farm, released by New World Pictures, and one that we discussed last August.
I've seen it.
Yeah. I don't remember liking that movie very much, but I'm willing to give it another try. Let's give it another go.
I'm willing to give it a try. Yeah, I'm willing. I mean, when I found out that he wrote with Ron Clark, I was like, that makes all the sense.
Is Ron Clark the brother of Bob Clark, who wrote A Christmas Story?
No. Though, Bob Clark made a lot of movies. I just assume
that all people with the last name Clark are related.
That's right. They're all related. It's a pretty unique name, so that's a really fair assumption. According to the poster, let's go through the cast that's on the poster, starting with Gary Coleman of the TV show Different Strokes, which was in its heyday. We're still going strong at this point in time. This is actually his second theatrically released movie following 1981's On the Right Track. Coleman told the AP in October 1982 that this movie was filled with great actors so that he could learn from them. He said, well, this picture has Don Adams, Cleavon Little, Dee Wallace, Ruth Gordon, Paul LaMatte, all good actors, no swell heads, all down-to-earth people. That was the basis for casting. Making the picture was a lot of fun, and since most of the actors had been in the business for a long time, I could learn from them. Naturally, the follow-up question from the reporter is, what did he learn from Ruth Gordon? To which Gary Coleman says, nothing, but she was fun to be with, and she has energy you can burn. It doesn't seem to matter anyway, because later on in this same interview with the AP, he said... he says this about acting. He says, quote, I just play myself. All I do is say the words the way I would say them. It's just play acting, and I'll keep on doing it until somebody says different.
Hey, Gary, different? Different.
Yeah.
Different. Hey,
and ironically, he's playing the straight man and the voice of the audience in this movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And evidently, for being someone who was cast as the lead in this movie, he is the main star. He hated this movie so much, he tried to be in it as little as possible.
So cut all my scenes out. I'm good.
He's not in this movie all that much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the cast of this movie is about 35 people that all that have some kind of name recognition.
That are all clawing for screen time.
They're all desperate trying to get something out of this. But they're not on the poster. But who is on the poster? Paul LaMatt, who was an amateur boxer hoping to join the U.S. Olympic team before making his debut in American Graffiti.
Mm. That's how we all started in the business, though, right?
Exactly.
I wanted to be, you know, an Olympic boxer. Mark.
Me?
Ryan. We I think all... you, Ryan, you were into pole vaulting, but that's, you know, we all... Most of us want to start as boxers.
Similar, different discipline.
I was my sawhorse skills back in the day were pretty sweet.
Oh,
so
maybe that's why you didn't join the boxing team then.
Stargrove.
Thank you for picking me up on that one.
Too focused on the sawhorse, didn't work on his uppercut.
Yeah.
Oh man!
Once I got those legs really swinging from side to side, I was just like, I can't stop.
And why would you want to? I'm not going to run out on this sawhorse till someone says different.
Different!
Mark different?
Mark different. Nope. Woo! Wait, actually, the sawhorse is like this.
Yeah, Eric, you know,
that's why I was a boxer. Good it's this.
It's good podcasting when Erica's just doing sawhorse with her
finger gestures.
Here. Yeah.
I'm a professional, Ryan. Ryan, I started as a boxer. I speak with my hands, all right? I let my hands do the speaking. Thank you.
Sure. Well, he did make his debut in American Graffiti, and he won a Golden Globe for his efforts. And then he worked with Jonathan Demme, who got his start with New World Pictures, on 1977's Handle with Care and 1980's Melvin and Howard. And in 1982, he also appeared in the slasher Death Valley. LaMatt told the Toronto Star in March 1982 that he was weighing another interesting offer. He said that he was mulling a sitcom series from the creators of Taxi. He said, quote, "It's very tempting because it would get me out of the dope, like the character of a dope, typecasting bit and into pure comedy. I would play a reformed alcoholic running a seedy bar. The only problem is that I could be tied up for
Sounds
5 years while I'd rather do films." It was hilarious, Mark, because Glenn and Les Charles, who were writers and producers on Taxi at the time, created Cheers, which would debut in September 1982 and was run by an alcoholic.
Well, the way you described it didn't sound as much fun. Didn't sound like a real, oh, that's going to be hilarious.
So it looks like LaMatt had a potential of getting Cheers. This is me speculating, but that was the first thing I thought of. In 1982.
But maybe it was Norm's character.
Right. Well,
I mean,
he's really thinking, yeah, Norm runs that place. He really runs it.
I read the script.
Wrong. He runs
he's not
it.
Wrong.
Yeah. He would appear, LaMatt, that is, not George Wendt. LaMatt would appear in Lonesome Dove series and also The First Puppet Master. But I bet he probably regrets not taking Cheers, if that was indeed the show and not just some...
We all regret that. I have also focused on boxing. I didn't accept it either. I was going to play Diane. But I was like, nope, I'm a boxer, not a waitress and idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Classic me.
Classic you. I was going to play the guy that runs the fish restaurant upstairs.
It's a smaller role, but very important. Yeah. Very important to the
talked about more than scene, but still important and a critical role.
Yeah.
The third act billed on the poster, Don Adams. The Get Smart actor had appeared in a movie version of that famed TV show in 1980 called The Nude Bomb. But I guess the show was still popular, despite only running from 1965 to 1970, because a year after this, movie, Adams starts voicing Inspector Gadget on that animated TV show. So I guess Get Smart was still, like, you know, in the zeitgeist. But here's who's not on the poster. Dee Wallace, who had just starred in E.T. the Extraterrestrial earlier that year, because this movie comes out in November, December of 1982. And E.T. it blows up to like $700 million in 1982 money in the summer of 1982. But let's not put her on the poster. Let's not move forward with Dee Wallace.
Did they make the poster in advance? And they were like, we can't change it. It's a PDF. What do you want me to do? I PDF'd it.
They don't even have PDFs back then.
It's a Word doc. If I mess with it, everything's going to be
all... It would have been something they literally printed.
It would have been a TIFF.
I can't fuck with the TIFF. It'll ruin it.
Can't fuck with the TIFF.
That's the shirt. That's the t-shirt. You can't fuck with the TIFF.
And they had a caricature guy. They hired this guy. He took a day off from working his job at Knott's to draw all these faces. And it's like, I can't get him back. I can't have him draw her in.
Oh, you want me to draw it in her? Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's baffles the mind why she's not on the poster for this. She's also a pretty big role, quite frankly. Yeah. And she's actually really good in this, of course. So, like,
you could argue she has as many lines, if not more, than Gary Coleman. I mean, I understand, Ryan. You could say that about everybody in this movie because he's hardly in this movie.
Mm-hmm. She's yet to really perfect her craft like she does in Shadow Play, also released by New World Pictures. We love that movie.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. That's a solid one. Underseen. Go check it out. Check out our episode on it. Anyway, here's where you can watch. If you want to watch Jimmy the Kid, here's where you can. It's on YouTube. That's it. There is a very expensive VHS if you want to buy it on eBay. I said, I'm not spending that much on a VHS.
Oh, somebody does have boundaries.
I do have boundaries, guys. I have limits.
Some restraint.
It is on YouTube. It's not a great version. So anyway, let's move on to what this movie is about.
Mark, what
is Jimmy the Kid about?
Yeah, look, we all want our parents to love us, but sometimes you have to accept that you aren't your mother's favorite child, and no matter what you do, no matter what you say, she will always love your brother in prison more than you.
Oh, man, do they run that bit into the ground, like, so fast.
They start with it, they lead with it, they carry it, they pick it up, they give it Gatorade, and they walk it all the way through the finish line. That joke ran a marathon.
It dies at one point. They resuscitate it. They have to get the paddles.
They get the paddles out. The joke comes back. You laugh. You get frustrated. You're annoyed. At the end, you're like, oh, they're still doing that joke again. Still.
It's the only thing that he and his mom talk about all the time. They talk about it constantly.
Erica, what's this movie about?
This movie, to me, really, it was very telling in that you can't just have one income, especially when you're an entertainer. Being a country music duo is not going to be enough to pay the bills. You also need to have a side hustle. And if that side hustle is real estate, perfect. So, you know, following your dreams is one thing, but if you want to be truly successful and rich, you got to have multiple income streams.
And if I may add to that, one of those income streams that's really important is your own private detective agency.
Yeah.
There's one thing we know about the 80s. That is a huge profit margin. If we learned anything from Moonlighting, if we've learned anything from this movie.
Magnum P.I., Ryan, you're missing out on a big one there. I mean, come on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course. I mean, that's where the real buku bucks are.
Yeah. Yeah.
I say buku on purpose.
Yeah, because it's buku.
Because we all know how much buku it's its own numeric value.
I challenge you, listeners, say buku out loud to yourself 4 times and see if it gets more or less ridiculous.
Don't say it in the mirror. Don't say it in the mirror. Whatever you do,
it's very important that you do not say it in the mirror. Just say it out loud.
Say buku in the mirror to yourself with your eyes closed, away from any mirrors.
And no more than 4 times.
Oh, if somebody says 4 times in a mirror, we are screwed.
God, there's a financial planner. He's going to appear. He's going to look at your last 4 or 5 years of tax returns.
No, you're He's going to tell you you're
doing everything wrong.
That's not a financial planner. That's an auditor. That's an IRS auditor.
Well, I don't want to scare people too much, but, you know, Mark's going to keep it real. It's an auditor. So,
well, for me, this movie is about the importance of reading.
Take a look.
Yeah. You got to read, guys. It's important to read. That's all I can come up with.
That's it. Hey, sometimes that's all it is.
But you know, it's important to choose what you read wisely.
All right. Well, you already gave what you thought it was about, Mark. You already said what you thought it was about.
No, I'm not saying what it's about. I'm just saying, Erica, I'm merely trying to reinforce Ryan's point that, you know, choosing the right book. In this case, the book that they choose is a book called Child Heist.
Yeah. No. This movie is about the importance of reading, but I think it's also about the importance of taking your paperback books and handling the binding really carefully so you don't ruin it.
I feel like you dragging out what this is about feels very familiar.
You don't want the book to fold over like this. You want it to stay.
No. You want the book to
We're all doing move our finger sawhorses.
You want it to move freely.
No one can see but us. So you're welcome, everyone. You're welcome. All right. Well,
I did a little cursory search to, like, are there books about adopting children or about the abducting? I know there's books about
adopting. There's definitely books about adopting children.
About abducting children?
Oh, no. You did a search on that? Uh-oh. That's probably not great for your Google history.
Got a little, cop stopped by. Just wanted to ask me a couple questions. But I think we're cool. I think I explained myself pretty well. I was saying, it's just scary.
Watch this movie, Jimmy the Kid. They're like, that does not track. No one has seen Jimmy the Kid. We don't buy that, sir.
He sat down and watched a few minutes. He was like, I believe you now. I got it. I got to go. So look, I took him, but he's like
a little adult. He's barely like a kid. Oh, boy. These handcuffs are tight. Woof. I always get car sick when I sit in the back. Just fair warning.
Can I ride shotgun? Warning. Let me ride shotgun. It's really important.
I'm going to put you in the drunk tank for the night. I'm not drunk. I watched that movie. You're watching that of your own free will. You're pretty wasted. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the Letterboxd synopsis. I'm sure you had an ending point. No, I'm messing with you. You looked up books on abducting kids. What did you find?
A cop came to my house and was asking me what I was doing.
No, but what did you find?
Honestly, I didn't find shit on it. If I did really start to click in and start going deep into some forums and trying to find stuff, I thought maybe I'm just going to go ahead and back out now. I don't need to go. Yeah. I don't really care.
Yeah.
I just wondered, like, are there books about kidnapping adults? Or say, like, middle-aged men who are just looking for something fun to do on the weekend. I don't know.
I feel like that's a crunch you only do once.
But I'm just saying, listeners, if you are interested in practicing your kidnapping skills just for, like, a weekend of fun, where we can just, like, you can work the pedals, I'll work the steering wheel, and we'll drive around on Highway I-80 somewhere in California. I'm down.
Wherever that is in California. You didn't crunch the I-80 in California numbers, did you?
Well, yeah, kidnappers aren't going to tell you exactly how the sausage is made. They can't tell you where I-80 is. That's a kidnapping highway. Everybody knows that.
Well, the reason for the I-80, I believe, and I don't know for sure if this is true, but the book of this movie is set in New York. So the I-80 might be in New York.
Hmm. I don't think we'll ever find out. We'll never know.
We'll never know. I don't
think there's any way to find out about that.
There's no way to ever know. If only we could type in I-80 New York into...
Interstate 80 is an east-west transcontinental freeway that crosses the United States from San Francisco to Teaneck, New Jersey.
There you go. So there is an I-80. Wow. There you go.
Teaneck.
Not in Los Angeles.
Not in Los Angeles. No, where this movie takes place. Here's the Letterboxd synopsis. Oh. We are on Letterboxd. Give us a follow there if you would like. Gang, this is how it starts. Gang of bumbling crooks.
Wow.
Not a, just gang of bumbling crooks kidnap a bratty little kid. He's not bratty.
He's perfectly polite.
He's got a lot of manners. Find out they got, how few letters, how few words can we do the synopsis? I want to get rid of any articles, anything that you normally would put into a sentence. Find out they got more than they bargained for.
No, they didn't. They got less than they bargained for. A lot less.
They not got at a all kid true.
Who's actually happy that he got kidnapped and is down to see where this goes.
He actually learns how to be a kid by just hanging out with them, which is something he wasn't before.
I don't think he ever learned to be a kid. I think that he understood when people say you should want to go to the carnival. But
he wants to go to the circus.
He's going to go. I know a carnival, circus, same fucking thing. When he
knows.
the only reason I will say no, you're wrong, is that Mark would say you're wrong. The Mark I know.
Aww. We've had a little switcheroo. Look at this.
He would say there's a difference between a carnival and a circus. So I just want to bring that up.
I would say there's a difference between a fair and a circus. Okay.
Okay. Oh, no. Okay.
But when he gets to said carnival or circus, he's going to fucking hate it. He's going to be like, I need to go home.
Yeah. He's like, I had it right before. I don't need
First
to
of all,
this.
He's going to wear a suit and it's going to be hot as shit.
It's going to be too hot.
At the circus, it could be way too hot. You're like, it is roasting. Nobody told me it was so hot at the circus. And now I'm sweating through this camel hair suit that I wore 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday.
Camel hair.
That's a thick fabric. Mm-hmm. But this movie was a book, and I just want to keep, it was something that my second time watching this movie, I was like, what is
you
this?
Watched it twice?
Oh yes. Which is why today has been rough. But I was wondering what was this like a Fletch thing where like, you know, it's a very accurate, you know, mostly accurate, let's say, adaptation where they're lifting, you know, scenes from the book and just putting them on screen. So I just looked up a little preview of the book today, and I have a preview of it, and I just want to kind of go through it real quickly because the book starts in the exact same way as the movie does, with our main character, John, trying to do a robbery and breaking in. And he comes across his partner, who says psst to him a couple times. And
does it also have Don Adams doing voiceover?
It does not have Don Adams doing voiceover. Nope. But this movie does start with his voiceover and he sets the scene. But he says, finally, his partner, Dortmunder. And he almost drops his chisel and he knows that it's his buddy. And he says again, Dortmunder, up here. Up. Jesus, Dortmunder whispered. Dortmunder, the creature hissed at him. It's me, Kelp. It's his buddy, Kelp. Oh, Jesus Christ, Dortmunder said. For Pete's sake, Dortmunder, don't be so noisy. Go away, Kelp, Dortmunder said. He spoke in a normal tone of voice, not giving a damn about anything anymore. I want to talk to you, Kelp whispered. May told me where you were. May has a big mouth, Dortmunder said. So do you, fella, a voice shouted from one or two buildings away. How about turning it off so we can get some sleep? Kelp whispered. Come up here, Dortmunder. I want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you, Dortmunder said. I don't ever want to talk to you. How would you like to see some cops? The voice yelled. Oh, shut up, Dortmunder yelled back. We'll see about that. Somewhere, a window slammed. Dortmunder said, I'm not going up there. You're going away. I'm going to stay down here and do my work. You're on the wrong floor, Kelp whispered. I am not, he said. It's there, an extra... That's the basement down there. The what? Dortmunder's hand found the chisel. He straightened, holding it, and frowned down into the impenetrable darkness. There was another story down there. He was sure of it. So this was the second floor. What do you think I'm up? I'm waiting up here. Count down from the roof. If you don't believe me, you're going to break into the store. I'm just in the same block with you, Dortmunder said. All things get screwed up. So then the window opens again. A light turns on in a window. Kelp says, come up here. You want to get caught? Okay, fella, the voice shouted. You asked for it. The cops are on the way. Another voice yells, why don't you people shut up? The first voice yelled, it isn't me. It's those other clowns. You got the biggest voice I can hear, shouted voice number two. How would you like to go screw yourself? Voice number one wanted to know. Another yellow window appeared. A third voice yelled, how would the two of you like to go down drown yourselves? Dortmunder, Kelp whispered, come on, come on. So that is how the book sort of starts, with me sort of editorializing there. But
wow,
let's hear how it happens in the movie.
Glad that the reading rainbow section of the podcast was over.
Oh, damn it, Dortmunder, you could have killed me.
Boy, that really hurt. That really hurt.
Son of a...
Get out of here!
No, I gotta talk to you. May told me where you were.
Hey, I'm busy. Can't wait till tomorrow.
What?
I said, can't wait till tomorrow.
No, I don't want to take any chances. You might get caught tonight.
I'm not gonna get caught if you get the hell out of here.
Hey, how about turn it off down there so we can get some sleep?
I'm talking to my friend down here, pal, so why don't you just butt out?
Look, I gotta get ready for work. Do you want me to come down there and punch you guys out?
What? Hey, hey, hey! Why don't you shut up? You're louder than they are.
Yeah, tell them.
You keep out of this, Tubby.
Hey, shut up down there. I got
it's a couple loud of kids mouth, trying no to sleep. Bum down there.
What'd you say? It's not me. I'm coming in. Come on, ladies. Come on, ladies.
And that was the only time in the movie that I went, oh, this might actually be funny.
And it is adapted from the book, but they just didn't bother to use the book for I don't know what reason. What we also don't hear, though, of course, as Mark said, was Don Adams at GetSmart with the voiceover as he's introducing these characters. And we do get to meet the crew, or start to meet the crew that Kelp and Dortmunder have. The main one being Dee Wallace, as we said, just, you know, recently of E.T. and a few years before New World Shadow Play. A year before Cujo, for that matter. And a few years from The Howling with Joe Dante in 1980. A future nearly New World movie. But they do have a plan.
Boy, you are a slow reader. What do you think?
It might make a good movie.
Don't you see what we've got here, Johnny? The damn book is a blueprint. All we've got to do is follow it.
I don't know, Andy. I mean, it's kidnapping, you know? That's not our style.
We'd never hurt the kid. They make a real point of that in the book. And see, the cops wouldn't be so hard on us later on if we gave the kid back and he was happy and unharmed.
Mm-hmm.
I read it.
Where'd you get this book anyway?
The prison library. During that 3 months I got for selling phony burglar alarms.
I don't like it. First of all, the caper takes place in New York.
Well, we gotta do it here. I mean, do you know how much it would cost to fly to New York?
Another thing, there's a lot of driving in that, and I won't drive.
You don't have to. I drive and my mother drives.
You're not bringing her into it.
You know how bad she'd feel if we left her out? Besides, crime is all she has to live for since Pa died.
Your Pa's a lucky man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love those little TV sitcom touches that are like, just in case you didn't catch that was a joke.
Right. There's those little bits. The opening credits look like they were leftovers from Get Smart. When I, at first I thought, did this movie come out in 62 or 82?
Yeah.
So there's, it's a weird mix of sort of Get Smart style comedic sensibilities, almost like a poor man's It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, but updated to like 1980s sitcom comedic style.
And yet, if you can hear in that clip, they're trying to adhere, at least they're trying to give fans of the book, I guess they're assuming fans of the book might actually still watch the movie, because number one, the story is originally set in New York, as we said. Mm-hmm. So they're mentioning that. He says, oh, it would make a good movie. Well, the ending of the book, not to spoil the ending of the book, is that Jimmy the Kid is a filmmaker in the book. And he runs off with the money and he makes a film about the kidnapping.
Mm. Oh.
So that's the end of the book. It's not the end of this movie. It's not what happens in this movie, but that's the end of the book. So there's lots of, when just looking up the book, I was like, oh, there's lots of little, you know, what we would now call Easter eggs in this movie that I guess they're thinking, well, this movie is going to be seen primarily by children and people who love these books. And that's, I guess, who they thought were going to do it. And they thought, and
us.
And us.
Who think and years later. Is hilarious.
And then people who love Get Smart. So let's make sure we fill it with that sensibility, which is an odd play. But we do meet Gary Coleman. He is, as we've talked about, he's a rich kid. He's got a maid that he's talking to, and he's mentioning that he's not very good at being a kid. He also has a driver, the driver played by Pat Morita, who is still about 2 years away from playing Mr. Miyagi, but finishing his run on Happy Days. So he's sort of right between those two touchstones of his career and doing his damnedest in this movie.
I mean, he's trying to make a mountain out of a molehill with this role. He's trying to get every inch out of it.
He has given one thing, which is that he's a driver and he can't see very well.
Is it also in this part where we are introduced to Jimmy's parents, Herb?
Yep.
And Nina.
His parents.
Singers. They've got a one night only they're going to be playing. So this is going to be a big deal.
Herb and Nina, that's the name of their act.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they get up on stage. They do their one hit, Get Your Paws Off My Dog. Nail it. Thank you, everyone. Good night. And isn't that the dream? As a musician, you get up there, sold out, one night only. You play, let's assume they played one more hit before that and it was cut out for time, but you get the big hit and then you're like, thank you, everybody, back to the trailer. But I have to say, as someone who frequents a lot of shows, there are many times I'm like, guys, just play your five hits.
Yeah.
And I could be in bed by 9:30.
Yeah.
Like we could wrap this up quick. We don't have to go an hour and a half. We don't have to.
If you were going to see Scottish rock duo The Proclaimers, you would be like, let's hit it with the Walk 500 Miles and let's do it, guys.
Yeah. That's all I got.
And then we can all bounce. And you guys can go to bed. Exactly. We can go to bed. We saw the thing you guys do.
Mm-hmm.
And we're good. I saw it live.
Yeah.
They're like, here's some stuff off our new album. I'm like, no, we just do it again. Do it one more time. Just for good measure. And then. and then we can all bounce. Mm-hmm.
But Herb and Nina, they got it down. They've got it down. They've also got a bazillion side businesses that they have to get back to. So it's not as though they're completely checking out. Yeah.
And they do have a full slate because they have tons of dates that they're going to play their one song and then bounce out.
Yeah.
By the way, Herb is played by Cleavon Little of Blazing Saddles. Mm-hmm. And man, did he deserve a better career than he got. Watching him in this, I was like, damn, like Cleavon Little is so good and so good in Blazing Saddles. And again, he's doing his best with this material. Nina is played by Faye Hauser. She had been in Roots, The Next Generations. And we need one more member of the party, and that's Ruth Gordon. And she's in one of her final roles. The Harold and Maude actress had just appeared in two Clint Eastwood movies with an orangutan.
Mm. Yep. Clyde was the name of the orangutan. Yes. That's right. For those who were wondering.
Every Which Way But Loose and Any Which Way You Can. And she plays basically the same person.
The feisty, is it his mom? And she's just how pissed about this orangutan living in the house. And then bikers come and pull up on her front lawn. And she's just doing a lot of, like this movie, get off my goddamn lawn. It's just a lot. It's a lot of that.
Yeah. It's the less mentions of the older brother that we don't meet that she likes more. And just more general sassiness. But the amount of times that people have been in those movies that have come up recently, I've just got to sit down and rewatch Every Which Way But Loose. It's coming up way too often.
It's coming up a lot.
Yeah.
Some of us need to sit down and watch it for the first time.
You were busy boxing. You didn't have any time to watch
it. Tell me about it. Tell me about it.
Not all boxers provide their own sound effects.
Ryan, you don't know the boxing breath work. Don't judge it until you've been trained to be an almost Olympian. God, just stick to pole vaulting, all right?
While across town. And I, after that sound effect you made, we just see a picture of a restaurant, because of course we're there.
Yeah, why not?
Oh, man. Meanwhile, Coleman is going to a therapist who is played by Gene Shalit. Mm-hmm. He's not played by... Gene Shalit.
It was Gene's daughter.
I wish.
He's actually played by Second City alumni Avery Schreiber. Mm-hmm. And his only New World movie, though he would appear in Saturday the 14th Strikes Back later on in the 1980s for Roger Corman's next company.
There's a sequel to Saturday the 14th?
Oh, yeah.
I never knew. This is a revelation. This is new news for me.
News break.
Wow. Wow.
New world news break.
You don't get often. Those don't happen very often.
That's right. At this point, at this stage, you know, we don't get stumped by new world history that much anymore. Well, but yeah, and apparently you were busy boxing.
I'm in one of those dangle bags.
The dangle bags, of course. The technical terminology, the boxing terminology, of course. It's been a while since I've seen Rocky II, and I need to rewatch it so I can hear what kind of sounds he makes when he shadow boxes. Shadow boxing. Do you shadow box? Yeah, I don't know what it is about Avery Schreiber in this role. He gets two scenes. He must have, I don't know, they must have really thought something about him in it, because he also, when it comes to the end credits and we kind of get the history of the characters, he comes up before Kelp does, the doctor that he plays. I'm like, was everybody so stoked to see Avery Schreiber? I mean, yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I think maybe the people making the movie were really stoked that he
was
in it.
Release the Snyder Cut of Jimmy the Kid. We want to see all those bloops.
It's two scenes where he's annoying and borderline creepy. And at the end of the second scene, he lays down on the couch next to Jimmy. because he's so distraught over Jimmy not wanting to go to the carnival or the circus or whatever. And I just thought, it's like ending on a cry. Where are we going to go from here? Fortunately, he's not in the movie again after that. So, I mean,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, he's doing like a German doctor.
Yeah.
Character. And mm-hmm. So.
It's weird.
He was in Get Smart. So, if that's any shock to anyone.
But in the meantime, we have Kelp and his buddy. Kelp's been following Jimmy the Kid around for 3 weeks. This guy is the antithesis of subtle, and how he hasn't been caught. Now, every time they have to go somewhere, he has to steal a car. And so he's been following him to the therapist meetings in a different car every time. When we finally see that this is the plan, he's stolen a Porsche, a red Porsche 911 SC Targa. Maybe the most obvious, like, why would you rent, like, steal a Datsun B210, something that no one's going to care. Why he stole that, I don't know.
It's of supreme interest to the sole cop mounted on a horse that happens to be just patrolling the streets at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Who are just patrolling the city of Sylmar. They've just got everybody on a horse. But two things annoyed me with that scene. One, when he fake tries to start the car, he's doing it on the right-hand side. 911s, you put the key in on the left-hand side. And then he says, oh, it's flooded. No, they had fuel injection back then. So you wouldn't have flooded the engine. So it's like, God,
that's where you lost Mark.
That's where you lost Mark,
Jimmy the Kid.
No. Everybody in the production was like, who's going to even be that familiar with this particular kind of Porsche?
Yeah, nobody will know.
You're right, though, Mark, that it's weird that that the movie tells us that he's been following him around and stealing different cars, and that has proven successful, because in some ways you can say, well, Kelp is, you know, look, he's really been putting in the time. He's a hard worker, at least. But literally everything they do in this movie goes wrong. They almost don't succeed in any way, the exception
and
of the fact
that... we're supposed to believe that he has successfully cased this whole joint, followed somebody around for 3 weeks, and hasn't been caught. Which then leads me to believe, though,
we just hear about him.
Mm-hmm.
But that leads me to believe that Jimmy knew the whole time and was like, I'm about to be kidnapped, but this could be cool. You know, it's summer. I'm off school. Who cares?
Yeah. And it's a huge debacle once it happens, but they do actually kidnap the kid. It's a mess how they do it. And I don't even want to get into the details. It's so stupid. They back a car into a moving truck. They do a bunch of dumb stuff, but still somehow, because again, Gary Coleman's very like courteous and being, you know, very accommodating to them, and not being a brat like Letterboxd wants to think he's being.
No, they kidnap him. He's in a van of a VW Vanagon, which I love because
a Vanagon?
A Vanagon.
Is that something that Volkswagen put out? A Vanagon?
That's what it is. A Volkswagen Vanagon.
That's hilarious. Absurd. What a hilarious
name.
That's what it is. It's a van again. It has a Wasser Boxer engine, which is very similar to what was in a 914, but and I think it was air cooled still at that time. But yeah, this big van that was powered by a very underwhelming engine, but they were enormously popular. They were the successor to the VW bus. Was the Vanagon?
None of that I know. The Vanagon. That's an absurd name.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, didn't I thought you were doing a bit. Turns out Volkswagen was.
Yeah.
They didn't think maybe we get a truck with a trailer long enough for a... Now, he says it's a Cadillac, but it does look like a Lincoln Continental to me. And then they smash the van again up. They all end up finally getting in the van again. They've all got these pseudo-Disney masks on.
But
they don't generic. Really look like generic Disney masks. They're and then we spend the next, I mean, in the movie it's the next 3 to 4 hours, but in viewing time it's maybe 15 minutes. Them trying to find the house that they're going to hide away in, which includes as part of this my favorite scene, which we'll get to later. But it's so and when they finally get to the house, their masks have sort of started to fall apart. Some of them have just taken them off.
Los Angeles rain that we had. Horrible
Los Angeles rain, that acid rain that they have. And by this time, we've also recognized that Jimmy is like, he's down to clown. He's like, sure, I'm in. This sounds, this seems like fun.
What do you think is happening in that? What do you think is happening there when they turn the lights out in that little cabin that they're staying in?
He's not down to pound. He's down to clown. Jeez,
thank you,
Ryan.
Erica.
Oh,
man.
Thank you.
Jeez.
Yikes. Gosh.
Yeah.
Ryan, always mishearing things.
But before they get to the house that they had planned to stay in, they decide to make a McDonald's run.
Oh, yeah.
Which is amazing because they're all in a single line. They're all yelling out their what they want at the same time. And Gary Coleman says, I'd like the chopped beefsteak sandwich. Is that made with real chopped beef? And I went, wait, what is this order that you're asking for? A chopped beefsteak sandwich?
Here comes the big beefsteak taste of McDonald's new chopped beefsteak sandwich.
Nobody.
The big taste of chopped beefsteak.
A big new taste for you, nobody.
Turned on a toasted French roll with slivers of onion.
It's big.
Nobody.
And our special recipe steak sauce on the side.
You're the reason we do it. Nobody can do it like McDonald's can. We made it just for you.
New chopped beefsteak sandwich, served after 4 p.m.
Oh,
wow.
After 4.
Yeah, after 4. It was exclusive.
That's a dinner item. That's not lunch nor breakfast.
Yeah, this is after a long, hard day of work. You get the chopped beefsteak sandwich. Unfortunately, it also was the most expensive item on the menu in 1979. It only lasted for 1 year. On average, a beefsteak sandwich would cost $1.20 to $1.80 each, depending on where you got it. Oof. Now, when you think about it, at the time, a burger at McDonald's was only 34 cents. This was an astronomical amount to spend.
But it's beefsteak.
It also makes, I know that this is a very visual podcast, but I didn't bring any pictures with me. If you look up the chopped beefsteak sandwich, somehow, amazingly, the McRib looks more tantalizing than the chopped beefsteak sandwich.
Oh, no.
I know that you're, I know what you're thinking. That's not possible. But look it up. Take a break, listener. Look up the chopped beefsteak sandwich. If you didn't already have one yourself in 1979, does not look good. Does not.
I did not know that about their menu, but we didn't really go to McDonald's a whole lot as kids.
No.
We live closer to a Carl's Jr., so that's if we went to one, that's where we went. So we didn't really, did not traffic often at McDonald's.
Oh, yeah. How boring.
Yeah. It does look,
That's an ample amount of steak sauce,
it's
too.
It's a ton of steak sauce.
God, it's like a carafe of steak sauce. Look at this. Damn, it's like a coffee cup of steak sauce. Like a
coffee mug of steak sauce.
It's like a French dip, essentially.
Ew, look, here's with it revealed outside the bun. Ooh.
Oh, those are
with
onions?
Onion nuggets?
Ooh.
Ooh. I could get down with some onion nuggets. I'm down to clown, Ryan, clown.
Oh, okay.
With some onion nuggets.
Okay. All right.
Down and pound some nuggets would have been an acceptable answer, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Because those nuggets, fuck.
Look at this one. The steak taste worth waiting till 4 for.
I love that they were like, ooh, let's get the adults in here after hours.
Well, in that scene, too, the last comment is Bernice saying, what, I'll take a bourbon and some fries?
Yeah.
And if you listen, someone laughs. So it seems to me like that might have been an ad lib because someone totally laughs in the background.
I hope so, for her sake. I mean, again, everyone's desperate to try to just get themselves something in this movie.
I'm just glad And that through your seething anger while watching this, you could still hear the faint sound of laughter in the background.
He wasn't hearing it. He wasn't hearing it out of himself, so he had to listen.
I wasn't hearing it out of myself. I was like, someone's having fun.
That means also now that we're 30 minutes now into the movie, and that's when we finally meet the narrator of the film.
Yeah.
It's only taken us 30 mm-hmm. minutes.
30 full minutes.
They'll call. I deal with situations like this every day. You sure you told us everything? Oh, everything I remember, Mr. Walker. They had guns and masks. It was so well planned. Like it was written out. I was really impressed. Good. Now, it seems like we're dealing with professionals here. That's good. That's good.
Good.
That means your boy is safe. Person is always better off being snatched by professionals. If at all possible.
I still think we should call the police.
Please, please, Mrs. Lovejoy. These people told your chauffeur no police. Now, seeing as your husband owns my detective agency, calling me in was the smartest thing you could do.
And he falls in the chair he just sat in.
I could really hear the Inspector Gadget in that clip.
Really? Yeah.
Also, in the background, woo-hoo! Did they record the audio? Like, was someone standing with a recorder next to the projector so you can hear the flicking yeah. of the projector?
Yeah.
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 It well, is pervasive through the entire movie.
Yeah, it is. Well, the YouTube version that's online is not great, but it's what you got. It's what you got. It's interesting that they like have the parents get the phone call from the kidnappers and they bring in the detective. It never feels like the parents are really too worried or bothered about it. I know they mention it once or twice, like, oh, I'm worried about my son. But then most of the time they seem mm-hmm. pretty relaxed.
Well,
he's still buying businesses. Like, she's, you know what I mean?
I know we're not at final questions, but do you think they've read his book? I mean, they're his parents. He's a child. Have they read his book?
No.
No?
I don't think so. They're too into their own careers.
Mm.
That's all they're concerned with.
Do you think they've read his book, Mark?
I agree with Ryan. I don't think they have because they are very passive parents. I mean, they're certainly like, why don't you do things like normal kids do? But at the same time, they're like, eh, but you're not really getting into trouble. So no big deal. We've got to go and play, you know, at a chicken restaurant in Vermont. You know, we'll be back in a few days. So
yeah, they're pretty detached. The maid and his driver to really raise him.
I felt like they read his book. That's why they weren't worried. They were like, he wanted this. He's manifesting this. He's putting it out there. I think
you're giving the movie a bit more credit than it earns. We don't know that he even writes the book. That's the big twist at the very tail end of the movie.
Oops.
That he admits he's the one that wrote Child Heist with that, which is a move that when we got to the end, I was like, he wrote the book? Give me a break.
I was laughing my ass off. He wrote the book.
Give me a break. A different TV show than Different Strokes.
Yeah. Nell Carter playing a similar type
role. I watched both equally.
Who didn't?
That's right. That's right. And so once they're in set up in their cabin, Jimmy quickly learns how to sneak out. So he does. He read it from a book because this movie is about reading books. And but he gets scared out in the night and he sneaks back in.
That's when he becomes a kid. He's still afraid of the dark.
Well, he's afraid of the dark. He's afraid of a sound of a creature he doesn't realize, which apparently they have cows out where they are. So he gets scared. He falls in a puddle. You fall in a puddle of dirty water. You're like, ugh, I want to get back home. Mm-hmm. I'm done.
Even if it's not your home, even if it's a home that your kidnappers brought you to that doesn't have any plumbing, you're still like, better.
And they do set up a drop-off, but not first before they make poor Ruth Gordon climb up a big giant pole and call the parents and listen to the concern in their voices.
Now, where was I?
You wanted to kidnap us.
That's right. Okay, do you have the money?
I do.
In a suitcase?
Right.
Now,
I want you to get in the car with the money. Use the Lincoln limousine.
What Lincoln? I don't have a Lincoln. I own a Caddy.
Oh, should be a Lincoln. Okay. I'll pencil that in later.
Use the Caddy.
Yeah. Now, where do I meet you?
Now, take the Caddy and...
drive to the Garden State Parkway.
The what?
Oh, wait.
That's New Jersey. Here, wait a minute. I got it written in the margin. Highway 80.
Highway 80.
That was Don Adams there in the background breaking glass and just generally goofing off while they're on the phone call. Nobody is concerned. It in moments where there could be stakes and you could break that tension with laughs, they won't allow any moment to feel real for a single moment.
Nothing feels real involved in this movie ever. Yeah,
there's no actual real emotion happening hardly at all. Except maybe some of the moments with Gary Coleman, like when he likes them and or when he's like, well, I'd like to be a kid. There's maybe some because you could maybe buy those moments, but they don't really have any weight or consequence. Here's another thing. I don't mean to be too critical, but this movie had zero fart jokes.
I know.
Listening to all those clips, it's just made me realize, like, saying just wait for the fart joke scene. Mm-hmm. It's been saying that since the first scene. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to give you a big fart scene because that's the kind of humor that we have.
Yeah.
And they don't.
Not a single fart.
They do not deliver a single fart.
Fart count zero.
Yep. We're like an hour in, and the last 25 minutes, because this movie's about 80 minutes, is essentially them trying to drop off the money and the kid, which essentially just means a whole lot of wild car driving from Pat Morita, who basically keeps turning the car around and going different directions. Like, that is how slow this movie is. This movie is basically an 80 minute movie with like 55 minutes of plot at best.
Yeah. Cause then at some point Pat Morita's out and now it's Dortmunder working the pedals cause he can't drive.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy steering. And the parents are following, and there's no way that would ever work. Like, even if you said hit the brakes, like how hard went I? It's crazy. I think that they didn't want to have a scene where the logical way to do this is you have Gary Coleman sit on his lap, you work the pedals, he does the steering, and I think that would have been a bridge too far, which I can't blame them for. But the way that they concoct that he is heads down by the pedals and trying to work the pedals while Gary Coleman steers is just asinine.
Yeah. Well, so the cops show up too, and they end up all fighting. And that's Pat Morita and Cleavon Little and the parents. It doesn't make any sense that they get in a fight with the cops. And then Don Adams like pushes over the cops at one point because he's like, we got to hurry and get over to where the boy is. And by the way, all of this is happening while he's wearing a dress so that he can pose as Cleavon Little's wife because they asked for just the parents. So he is trying to pose as the mom of Gary Coleman, which the makers of this film thought this is the moment. This is the moment of this movie.
This is peak hilarity.
Is what people are going to walk out of the movie theater going, holy crap, Don Adams in a dress.
At one point in time, Pat Morita has been spinning them around and doing donuts. And Gary Coleman Jimmy takes off and Jimmy's dad says, oh, I've lost my boy. And Don Adams' character says, well, I lost one of my boobs because it flew, the stuffing flew out of his bra. This is like the kind of humor that they just keep going back to the well. They are going back to that well for the last 45 minutes of the movie. Although I will give Don Adams credit that at one point, as they're speeding off and he yells a line back to the cops that were chasing them, he says, may a camel lose its lunch on Eric Estrada. And I thought, that is fucking ridiculous of a statement.
That felt personal.
And I don't know if that was an ad lib, but Listeners, that's the movie that you're watching if you decide to watch this movie.
And there's a key reason why they say Eric Estrada that I'll get to in research.
Oh.
There's a reason behind it.
Oh.
Can I leave before the research section? Is
that a... No, you're
stuck.
I don't
think we want to leave you're right stuck. Now because there's things we loved. And things we hated.
That's right. We're going to talk about the things we love and the things we hated about Jimmy the Kid. Mark, what did you love?
I did love the dad's, I guess, nervous penchant to work out deals with his broker anytime that anything stressful is happening. So he's bought like a chain of Greek restaurants in Kansas. He's bought a cement factory in Detroit. And then later on, when things are getting really tense and he's losing his son, he's saying that he bought a pet cemetery with a miniature golf course attached to it. And I thought, you know what? That's kind of a cool idea. I mean, think about it. You could have four golf courses or four sections. You could have the original pet cemetery section where it's like, you've got to get the ball under before the truck drives over it. You know that the reincarnated cat that keeps switching away at the ball, trying to swipe it away. The last hole is the Achilles heel. Don't get your Achilles cut as you try to get that last one in. And then like the second one would be like the go furlong course, where it's like a lot of Edward Furlong
in the sequel.
So you're going to have a lot of him and like Anthony Edwards, not the Anthony Edwards from the Timberwolves, the one from Revenge of the Nerds and ER. Like I got to figure out how he's going to work out there.
OG no one Anthony thinks Edwards. Of the Timberwolves guy first. Everyone thinks of ER first. Everyone.
And then they have the other two courses, but I don't really know like what they would have on them yet. Cause I mean, and we have time. No one saw those movies anyway, so we can figure it out. But I think you could mix the two and have something really cool there.
Yeah, you just like a Pet Sematary and the sequels and reboots, all the movies themed into three different courses, but also dead pets.
Yeah. Exactly. Do you think that would comfort people as much as you think?
Yeah.
I just buried my childhood pet, and now I'm going to just do a quick nine holes. I think
it would be fun to like go say, oh, well, it's sad. Let's go see Fluffy, and then,
Just make sure they serve onion nuggets.
Only after 4 p.m.
Oh, that's right.
You got to work the late shift at the pet cemetery. Erica, what's something you loved?
I loved that this movie felt both long and short. That while watching it, I was like, my God, how much longer? And when it was over, I the next day felt as if I hadn't watched it at all. So
you really love how forgettable it was.
Yeah. 80 minutes spent.
I'm hoping by tomorrow I'll forget it entirely. And it will just be like, what did I do last night? I don't know. There's a weird brownout. Like where I don't remember exactly what I did.
I don't know.
I don't know what happened.
I woke up and I was like, Gary Coleman. Why am I thinking about Gary Coleman? What I loved was the cast.
Yeah.
I love the cast of this. It's a, what's that?
All of the cast.
Not all the cast, but I mean, this has got a great bunch of great people not doing their best work, but I love that they got a great cast. And again, I've said it before, but a special shout out to Pat Morita, who is just, I think, in terms of having nothing to do.
Yeah.
He is making the absolute best out of having nothing to play.
I'm also a shitty driver and I can't see, but nobody's glowing. Nobody's giving me a glowing review.
You're not doing comic bits out of it.
Nope, I'm just putting people's lives at risk.
All right, let's switch to things we hated. Mark, what did you hate?
This movie is my cries and whispers.
It is called Whispers and Cries.
Here's the thing. I get when you make a comedy and certain types of comedies, you're going to have some wacky characters. And I'm fine with that. But when everyone is a fucking idiot, I find it's 80 minutes of me being annoyed as shit. Like, nobody can figure out anything. Nobody can. And Gary Coleman's the closest that we have, but he's not a believable child at all. He's the grown-up in the room.
Movie, as you brought up.
And he's barely in the movie.
Yeah.
You have long segments where he's not even there. And so you're just everyone from the parents to Don Adams to the cops. I mean, everyone's a fucking idiot. And you're like, this is it's so miserable to watch.
If when you watch this movie and then you learn that the two main characters of the book that this is adapted from are John and Kelp, you're like, really? Because they're also side characters. Like they're the leads. They were the leads in the book because they're barely in this movie too. Like it's really evenly distributed amongst just the ton of people they have in here, with the emphasis on Don Adams and just a little bit of Gary Coleman. And it's like, I don't understand that distribution. And Erica, what did you hate?
I hated that this movie felt both really long when I was watching it. Like I was like, oh my God, it's only 80 minutes long. It felt so long. And then also really short. Like I have no memory of watching it. Like I watched it yesterday and I feel like I don't remember anything about it.
So just interminable to watch and then forgettable.
Yeah.
So it's frustrating. I get it. I mean, I'm with you, Mark. I had to look up the book today just because I was like, what happened in this movie? This is going to be in my bottom five without a doubt. I mean, this was just frustrating for me to watch. Sometimes it's like, you know, when we had Allie on and we were talking about the funny farm, sometimes it can be so frustrating to watch comedy when, you know, you love comedy like we all do and have it be this poorly executed. And I mean, like on almost every level, there's no one person to blame here. The director is capable. The editor is very capable. Maybe the script going so far off from source material that was there that you kind of are utilizing.
But should you blame the author of the book?
But the book seems all right. That doesn't seem bad. The way that this looks, I know the YouTube copy is really bad and it looks like it's, you know, being shown through mud, but whatever. They shoot almost everything in a wide shot. It's a group shot almost always. They don't punch in a lot. There's a scene where Kelp is like trying to draw up a plan and then he realizes he has the paper backwards. We never cut in on anybody's reactions. We don't cut in on him. We don't cut in on the paper. It's like, we don't know how to make a comedy. And it's so frustrating because it's like, why are you all making this? You don't know how to do this.
And the director also didn't know how to make a sci-fi movie with the fucking black hole.
The black hole is a fucking masterpiece next to this. It is.
Right. But it's not. But it's a shitty movie.
I don't hate the black hole. But I mean, next to this,
Wow. The Funny Farm is a decent viewing.
The fucking black hole is like, it's like Alien next to this movie. It's like fucking, it takes so long for anything to happen. Forget the fact that there's no stakes. Just driving up to try to hand off Gary Coleman. It's like, it's so long. It's everything takes forever for them just to do one thing. And they're like, you got to be on board. Right. And it's like, no, I let me get involved. Get me into the characters. You immediately set them up to be so inept that you realize you don't have to, you shouldn't take any of this seriously, of course, but then like, but how am I supposed to care about anyone or root for anyone or, I don't know. This was just a very frustrating watch for me. And difficult. Favorite scene. Let's talk about our favorite scene, Mark.
Favorite scene is when they are looking for the house that they are going to hide away in with Jimmy. And they go to the first house and realize that they had gone to the wrong house and the people come out. The reason why I like this scene so much is there's a little VO as they're getting out of the van again saying that, oh, the kid's asleep, so we'll just carry him in. And it is so obviously a doll.
Oh, yeah.
It is like ridiculous. And in multiple shots, it's not even one shot. Like the walking up, it's a doll. And then when they walk back, they're running back to the van again because the owners are, they have a gun and now they're, you know, it's the, oh, get off my lawn. They're running. At one point, Kelp is like basically just picks up what should be Gary Coleman, who's got like skinny little dangly legs because it's just a doll, just picks him up with his two hands and just throws him into the van. And I'm like, you didn't even try to sell that. This was a person.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Forget it. Throw him in.
There's nothing like a good doll. I love scenes where they use dummies when they throw them off buildings and stuff. It's like literally one of my favorite things ever. Yeah, good dummy doll. That's a good call. That's a really good call. Erica, your favorite scene?
My favorite scene is when Dee Wallace is waiting by the phone booth and she is the person who gets the critical phone call and she's going to make the connection. And then a biker gang rides up and steals the phone.
Out of the phone booth.
Of the phone booth.
Yeah.
Because it made me think, like, was that a real thing that happened? Like, was that a common...
Sure.
Did people steal phones out of the phone booths? And yeah, it seemed... super random and
they were like really polite about it.
Really polite and calm about it. Like, okay, we're gonna leave now.
I guess favorite scene. It was really hard. I couldn't think of anything. I was like, I guess at opening credits because they were animated, and I was like, who knows what this could be. And
it was, you know, a good opening.
It was
credits.
Probably the most
that made me angry from the beginning. I was like, what the fuck? This, because it's like such 1960s style cartoon stuff. I'm like,
it is.
What am I watching?
It is. But I felt like, I don't know. Who knows what we have in front of us? It's not white letters on a black screen. So who knows? Like, this could be something. Though you brought up the McDonald's scene, obviously, and that probably was one of the funnier actual moments of the movie. And it's 25 seconds, but it's still was, again, made sense for you to shoot them all in one shot with them as the whole group because they're all talking at once. So it makes sense that they would all be shown at the same time. Anyway, it's time for final questions. Here are our final questions for Jimmy the Kid. Before this movie, had you ever heard of Loudbox?
No. I think it was speakerphone or a speaker. Let me put you on the speaker.
Yeah.
I never heard of Loudbox before.
Yeah.
Never heard that.
That was very... This movie also, we didn't talk about this, but this they really pushed the boundaries of what a car phone technology could really pull off. Like, they were really like... This is the early 80s. Car phones did exist, but they were really not as... They didn't work as this well.
No,
they were really
These
guys are rich, so they will have somehow conquered the lack of technology that we currently have for car phones.
Yeah.
But they were very hopeful that it could get better.
Yeah.
And that's what this movie, you know, posits a world where connections are fast, it's clear, there's no drops. The world. Rich people can do that.
Why do old ladies hate wet panties?
Where do I begin? Oh boy. I'll take this one, guys. Don't worry. You feel like you've peed yourself.
Yeah. And maybe you have, you know,
maybe you have, you know, at a certain advanced age that some of us are already at, you might forget about why they're wet. And you're like, is this a good wet or a bad wet? And nobody wants to be in that.
Nobody
position.
Wants to be in even the good wet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To be fair, you usually want to be in the good wet. If you have a choice.
Usually.
If you have a choice.
I know the ending is supposed to be just like a big laugh of just insane hijinks, but like in reality, they're all going to jail, right?
Oh, 100%.
Oh, yeah. Without question. Yeah.
100%.
No. Yeah.
Like every single person, the parents, everyone.
Yeah.
Probably the kid is going to, I don't know.
Foster home.
He's going through the system. Like everyone's. If you were forced to rewatch this or Bad Manners, which would you choose?
Oh. Bad Manners.
This one is shorter.
I'm going to say Bad Manners too. Way Without more question. Going on in Bad Manners.
Way
bad
more.
Bad Manners, Bad Manners.
All right, let's get into some research. Gary Coleman's production company grabs the book rights to Jimmy the Kid in January 1980. Besides making On the Right Track, now at the time, Gary Coleman had this production company, Zephyr Productions, and he'd set this up so that in between seasons of Different Strokes, he would make a movie. And they started with a couple movies that were on TV, and then they made On the Right Track. But they also had another project as well.
Oh gosh.
They had another project.
Guy was a machine.
He had another a project, which was a four-hour TV miniseries called Evita, First Lady, that starred Faye Dunaway. That's with Zephyr Productions. It was released eventually as Evita Peron over two nights on NBC. Gary Coleman is not listed as a producer, but oh my God, I wish he was.
Wow.
How amazing would it be to sit down watching NBC and watch Evita Peron? Let's see what this. Oh, Gary Coleman's the producer. A 12-year-old boy. That ought to be good.
Don't cry for me, Gary Coleman.
This movie is shot May to June 1981 in Los Angeles on a $4 million budget. It's not until another year later, because here's the thing. On the Right Track was released by Fox, 20th Century Fox.
Okay.
And it makes like, you know, it's made for $2.5 million. It makes about $5 million maybe. And so, you know, it makes something. It's not huge, but it makes something. So they make this movie and think, ooh, Fox is going to line up, get this movie. Well, Fox is uninterested, unmoved. Mm. To get this movie. And so they go around trying to sell it and they can't. So that's when New World steps up and goes, oh, we'll take it. But that's not for like a year.
Did they film it on spec? Like who funded the money to make it?
The production company. Because Zephyr Productions is Gary Coleman's company. And so Corman decides this is going to be our Christmas movie for 1982. It premieres in November.
Okay.
And it makes anywhere between 5 to 10 million, according to Corman. Who knows? I think he was also given like a guarantee by selling it to him, because of course they were just trying to get this movie out. Mm-hmm. So whatever that guarantee is, who knows? When it comes to Corman and the numbers, he's a tough source to truly trust. But I will say that Coleman was hoping to make more movies after this. He also told the AP this. He said that he would like to continue to make more movies, quote, good movies, not great movies, but the kind of things that John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd have done.
Mm.
Which is like a real backhanded compliment.
I don't know. I think that's a backhanded insult.
Yeah.
Like, fine movies, you know, fucking like Dan Aykroyd
Blues
movies.
Brothers, F.
Yeah. Ugh, I don't know.
Yeah. So
1941 was a piece of shit.
Yeah. Well... he would make a few more movies, that is to say Gary Coleman, but they're TV movies, and they are ones that New World would release in one way or another, but he would not make another theatrical film.
Oh, Gare.
What was the one that he was living in, like the train station or whatever?
That's On the Right Track. That's on the one right he makes track. Before this.
Yeah.
He's living in a locker in the train station in Chicago.
I remember that.
And so why is this movie significant to New World history? Well, because... the real paycheck for Corman was because of the partners at Zephyr Productions. And those are the executive producers of this movie, Harry Evan Sloan and Lawrence Cuppen. Those are the two guys who ran Zephyr Productions. Those were lawyers. They started out as entertainment lawyers. They're entertainment lawyers for Ron Howard, for Gary Coleman, obviously, and also Eric Estrada. Was also one of their clients, which is why he's mentioned in this movie.
Got
funny.
It.
And Todd Bridges and Dana Plato getting left out of that one. That's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, he took no one else from Different Strokes. No, I mean they had more clients than that. I'm just mentioning a few of those, one of those being Eric Estrada. So they basically make this movie with Corman, and actually they start talking to Corman once he buys this movie. And they start talking to him about potentially buying New World in 1982. And they go back and forth, and they finally get settled on a number. He sells New World to them for $16.5 million. Corman initially wanted 22. They wanted to do 12 or 13. But basically, they were just trying to get in the movie business. They just wanted to buy a movie studio. And the thing that they talk about, now I have Roger Corman's New World Pictures, Mind Warp, the fantastic story of Roger Corman's New World Pictures. And they have a quote in here from Harry Sloan, who said, quote, "Roger pointed out something that I had not thought about. There were four main companies, AIP, Allied Artists, Avco Embassy, and New World, distributing lower budget films or so-called B-movies in the 70s. As we sat with them in 1982, three had all but disappeared." So what they realized is, like, this is the low budget studio. Mm-hmm. If we buy this, we can just start making movies. So they bought this movie, and it's Jimmy the Kid that is the catalyst for Roger Corman to sell New World Pictures.
Wow.
I mean, with the quality of Jimmy the Kid, it's no surprise that Roger Corman was like, these are the guys that know good movies. I'm going to sell to them.
Yep. All right, that is it from us. We hope you enjoyed the beginnings of Ha Ha, Guess 2, Double Take. We're going to talk about the comedy movies, or dry, lacking in jokes comedies sometimes, of New World Pictures. You can listen to all these episodes at our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com, where we have our episodes, our articles, our t-shirts. Buy a t-shirt that helps support the show, or give us a 5-star review or a good podcast comment wherever podcast comments are available. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.